Happy Friday, everybody. We have made it through another week, or at least we're close to making it through another week. But happy to be here with you. Welcome to our ESPN studios here in Northern Nevada on this kind of sunny, kind of cloudy Friday, May 22nd. But nonetheless, good day to be here and good day to be talking some sports. We got a fun 2 hour slate for you. Coming up this hour, of course, our pals Terry and Sean will join me over the phone, get to hear what those guys are up to, what they got planned this weekend. A certain general manager in the NFL not concerned about how his head coach and quarterback will get along, so we'll talk about that. Also, we got some more combat coming up this weekend. Any wrestling fans out there, All Elite Wrestling's Double or Nothing pay-per-view for this year is this weekend. So I'm going to go ahead and rank the first six AEW pay-per-views they've had so far. And talk about that, then end the first hour, taking a look at some possible returns in the world of boxing as well, which you may have seen. So that is coming up here in the first hour, but I'm going to start in the world of the MMA, because, or I should say in the world of the UFC, which is a part of MMA. But either way, I just felt like an idiot the way I said that. But let's talk about how and when a corner should step in, because that's been a big topic of discussion since the UFC Fight Night event that saw Anthony Smith and Glover Teixeira take part in the main event. And, of course, Anthony Smith came off pretty badly beaten in the fight, suffered a broken nose, a broken orbital bone. He had a cut under his right eye, along with losing some teeth during the fight to Glover Teixeira. And many on social media, as well as some members there of the broadcast team, Daniel Cormier being one of them, thought that that fight should have been stopped a lot earlier. I mean, whether the ref did it or whether his corner threw in the towel, somebody should have stepped in. However, in an interview with ESPN earlier this week, Anthony Smith wasn't so sold on his team having to do that. He said, quote, "They're in a tough spot. I don't know if they wanted to stop it or thought about it, but I take that option away from them before we have ever gotten to that point. If you want to sit in my corner, that's my rule. You don't stop the fight. You just don't. Leave it in my hands," end quote. Which I feel like is really the attitude of every fighter, isn't it? I mean, they don't want the fight to be stopped. They want to continue to have a chance to win the fight. But it is important to watch out for people's health, the same way that a basketball coach or a football coach or a wrestling coach has to watch out for the health and safety of their players and make sure that they are healthy and you know, in the correct mental and physical state to be able to compete at a high level. And even if you don't want the fight to be stopped, you still have to think about, as a coach, you have to think about your fighter's health. And the fighter might not like you for it. He might hate you and he might choose to leave your team because of it, but I think ultimately it is a coach's responsibility to have to step in and make that call, as however difficult it may be. And ESPN, I think specifically Brett Okamoto, decided to talk to a couple different coaches from around the world of MMA and get their thoughts on it, and they all kind of had the same general thought process, whereas the thought was, if your fighter has absolutely no chance to win, that's when you throw in the towel. And again, that's a point where do you really say your fighter has no chance to win? We've seen in fights where guys are just getting their rear ends handed to them for, I mean, if it's a boxing match, maybe 8, 9, 10 rounds. If it's an MMA match, maybe the first 2 or 3 rounds. And then all of a sudden they can have that one-shot power. They land that one shot where it turns the whole tide of the fight around, and maybe you throw in the towel 20 or so seconds before that shot gets landed. Now, of course, you don't know that shot's coming, but that's kind of the hard part of being in that situation, where you see your guy getting rocked and you see him not having a lot of offense. And yeah, he might be trying to fight back, or maybe just trying to fight, you know, buy some time, but he could be on the brink of landing that one shot. Now, some fighters don't have that one shot power. And if they don't, it might be a little easier to judge when you can throw the towel in. But if you have a guy like, let's say, a Francis Ngannou that has that one shot power, all he needs is one uppercut or one straight shot to the face to really end the fight, you don't want to take that kind of opportunity away from him and throw the towel in. And that's the kind of moral dilemma that goes through that. There was one coach that did say he looks for, quote, quote-unquote, permanent damage. So he used an example of the only time he's thrown the towel in on a fight was when his fighter was just getting pelted in the legs. I mean, just kicked repeatedly and repeatedly in the legs. And while that might not sound like it would be a good enough reason to throw in the towel, fighters have died from blood clots in their legs due to those types of kicks. So he saw his fighter just unable to really hold himself up, unable to really throw any offense, and he was just getting pelted, and he thought that there could be permanent damage done to his legs, to his career, and possibly to his overall health, so he threw in the towel. And again, that is a tough position to be in, but when you read about all this and you see how about it, they reference boxing a fair amount as well, how boxing cornermen aren't afraid to throw in the towel. And, you know, they pointed out that the frequency of how boxers used to go about it, while they don't have a fight every 2, 3, or 4 weeks like they used to way back in the day, but you still have a boxer that can have more boxing fights every year than an MMA fighter. And part of that, I think, is because MMA isn't really willing to throw the towel in yet. And while I can understand that, I think everybody understands that from a competitive perspective, that you want your guy to have every chance that he can. You want your guy to be a champion. And something else that came up with a lot of these coaches is that they would think about throwing in the towel earlier if it wasn't a title shot. If it was a title fight, since that could be a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-career-type opportunity, they would give their fighter a little bit more time before thinking about throwing in the towel. And then, but what do you do if you have a fighter like Anthony Smith? And he says, you're not throwing it in. Period. You're not throwing it in. How, I mean, do you want to face, as a coach, right, you have to kind of control the aggression from your fighter. If you throw in the towel and he starts coming at you like that, I mean, you got to be able to defend your point and hope that he understands. Or she understands, whoever it is. Because it's not an easy position to be in. And I think boxing is more comfortable with it, because there's just a different mentality around it. There's a different mentality around boxing and cornermen with their fighters and really kind of seeing. Because I feel like in boxing, I mean, you have guys that switch trainers, but I feel like for the most part, a boxer's with a trainer for most of their career or a good part of their career. So there's that comfortability there. I feel like, not to say that most MMA fighters jump around gym to gym, but I feel like because the sport is still on a rise and you have teams that are still forming and gyms that are still forming, it's more likely to see fighters kind of jump maybe to, you know, fight for two or three gyms throughout their career, depending on, you know, different levels and going to different promotions or whatever that might be. So the comfortability between trainers and fighters might not be there. And that's a big part of it, too. If your fighter trusts you, even if they don't want you to throw in the towel, if they trust your judgment and you throw it in, you go, you know what? I feel like I could have kept fighting, but they know me. They could see maybe what I couldn't feel. And there you go. Because, you know, the adrenaline, I mean, adrenaline is going through every competitor. You think about a football game or a fight or a basketball game or a wrestling match, whatever it is. You're just in that high adrenaline type of mode. And even though they can control their emotions, that adrenaline is still flowing through your body. And a lot of the times these guys don't feel major injuries, you know, until after the fight's over. Unless, you know, you're Anderson Silva and you snap your leg in half. But otherwise, you know, you don't really feel a lot of that stuff till after the fight. So they might not feel it, but a trainer that's watching their fighter not be able to throw the same power punches, not be able to, you know, go for that quick submission or go for that quick takedown that they're so used to seeing and so used to performing, that could be the opportunity for them to then step in and say, you know what, you're just not with it. You're just not there enough, and, you know, throw in the towel. And I hope that if we do see that, if we do see a day, because I don't recall ever seeing a towel thrown in the UFC. I don't watch a whole lot of Bellator, I don't watch a whole lot of Titan FC, I don't watch a whole lot of anything else besides the UFC in terms of MMA, so I can't tell you how often it happens in that sport in general, but watching UFC fights, I can't recall ever seeing a cornerman throw in the towel for their fighter. I've seen the doctor obviously stop a fight. Doctor steps in, you know, takes a look, the cut's too deep, or just the fighter's just not with it enough, the doctor will call the fight. That happens plenty. We've seen plenty of doctor stoppages throughout the UFC and their history. But maybe it happened, you know, in the earlier days back when the UFC didn't have as many rules and regulations and it was more just kind of a free-for-all, like back in the UFC 1 or 2 days. But I don't personally recall ever seeing a coach throw in the towel in the UFC. And I hope that we get to a day where cornermen and coaches feel comfortable doing that. And maybe they have to fight off, you know, pushback from their fighter. But I hope that the media and analysts and other people, you know, that talk about the world of sports, if they do see that, remembers nights like Anthony Smith and Glover Teixeira and then doesn't go right after that team. Because I can see in my mind, the first time we see the towel thrown in, maybe the team goes a little too early. And all of a sudden, people just jump on saying, how can you stop the fight then? Your fighter still had this. Your fighter was still doing this. Because the last thing we need is for all of us to be talking about, man, it would be so much better for coaches to throw in the towel in MMA and save fighters from maybe a beating like Anthony Smith got. And the first time it happens, people call them out on it and say it was a bad idea. That's my fear. That's what I don't want to have happen, because I think throwing in the towel is a natural, you know, part of fighting. If your fighter just doesn't have it and the ref doesn't want to stop it, the cornermen should feel comfortable doing that. And it's not something they're necessarily trained in. I mean, you'd hope the doctor would step in if the ref doesn't before you would have to. But that's that kind of system of checks and balances that the fighting world has. The ref is going to look at the doctor and the coach is kind of on their own thinking, you know, do I need to throw in the towel or not? And they can talk to the ref and they can talk to the doctor, but it's up to those three parties to kind of be on the same page. And if they're not, someone has to step in. If the ref's not going to do it, it's up to the doctor, the ringside doctor, or it's up to the cornerman. And I hope that we get to a day where cornermen or women, or coaches in MMA, feel accepted by throwing in the towel and feeling like that's an okay thing to do if your fighter just doesn't have it anymore. If they are taking, you know, permanent damage or they don't have a chance to win the fight anymore. I mean, it shouldn't be looked at as a sign of weakness. It should be looked at as a fighter and a coach being on the same page and a coach doing whatever, you know, what any other coach would do in any other sport, you would hope at least, and that's protect their fighter and make sure that their health is the first priority. But I'm okay with it. I'm okay with people throwing in the towel. I'm okay with it in MMA. I'm okay with it in boxing. And I don't even think it's really that controversial for someone to throw in a towel. I mean, it's instead of the ref stopping the fight, the coaches, you know? I mean, it at some point, someone's going to have to stop the fight unless it goes, you know, the full distance and goes to the judges' scorecards. But otherwise, I don't really see it as that controversial to begin with. But hopefully we get to the day where we're okay with it, and if it happens, we don't go ballistic. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, hopefully our pals Sean and Terry will be on the phone, and we'll see what they have been up to. That's coming up next on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, sometimes life gets in the way, so unfortunately, we will not be able to hear from our pals Terry and Sean today, but hopefully those guys have a nice weekend, and we'll get to talk to them next week. But nonetheless, we'll continue to roll on, because the world of sports, even though we are, you know, at a minimum for live events, continues to offer up some interesting news. And some news coming across from the NFL just a few minutes ago. And that is that the New York Jets are signing Joe Flacco to a one-year deal. Now, Jets general manager Joe Douglas was a Ravens scout in 2008 when Baltimore drafted Joe Flacco. So obviously he's very familiar with him and familiar with what he's done. Obviously Flacco winning his one Super Bowl ring with Baltimore in that exciting Harbaugh Bowl, or the Blackout Bowl, whichever one you like to call it. The game that went down in New Orleans where half the lights just shut off and blew a fuse as we were getting ready to, you know, get into the second half. But nonetheless, he now gets reunited, and he's going to be a part of the Jets roster. And when he becomes healthy and ready to play, he will compete for the backup position. And I think that's smart. You know, lay out what the plan already is, because we know that Sam Darnold is going to be the guy there in New York for the Jets, which makes sense. He's the guy that they bought into. He is the one that has been the leading, you know, starter most of his time there in New York. And although it hasn't been smoothest of play there for Darnold with the Jets, it still makes sense for him to go, you know, and be that leader for that team. So I think it's good for him. He'll be competing with David Fales and James Morgan for that backup position right now, although Joe Flacco is listed as the second-string quarterback, but he'll continue to compete for that spot when he becomes healthy. And again, you think about, you know, some of these guys like Tua Tagovailoa, who can now study under Ryan Fitzpatrick. You think about Jordan Love under Aaron Rodgers. If you can get these young guys with a older mentor, with somebody that has experience, and especially if you can get him with somebody that has a championship, I think that'll do incredibly, you know, it'll really help them progress as not just players on the field, but team leaders as well. And for Joe Flacco, you know, his time in Denver was, I think, disappointing is a fair way to phrase it. Obviously, it was cut a little short by injury and not being able to play out a full season. But I also think for the most part that, you know, he has some good insight and he has some good advice that he can pass along to Sam Darnold, because Joe Flacco was a guy that really came out of, you know, came out of Delaware and wasn't seen as somebody that could really be, you know, a champion. He didn't have a whole lot of buzz around him, and he kind of just continued to get better as he was in Baltimore. And, you know, ended up leading them to that championship in 2012. And although he kind of fell off the wagon after that, he still went on to set some career bests in Baltimore after winning that. He had his best passing yard season came in 2016 when he threw for 4,317 yards, just about 500 more, actually exactly 500 more than he threw in his championship winning season. And 95 touchdowns long was his 95 yard throw that season, which is his career best in 2016. So even though the overall play kind of went downhill for him and for the Baltimore Ravens after they had won that championship, he still had times where he was producing and showing that he could still be that guy for somebody's team. And going to Denver and only playing 8 games in that one season, obviously then due to his injury, it's not a great look for him. And it's obviously not the way he probably wanted that stint in Denver to go. But I think that's still an opportunity for him to learn as well, and as he continues to learn, because I think for Joe Flacco, those first 4 years he was in the NFL, he kept leading Baltimore to the playoffs. They kept looking like they were a team kind of on the verge. They finally win in 2012, and then there's this kind of stutter from the team and from him, and we're all kind of waiting to see if he can pull himself out of that and get back to that Super Bowl caliber type of performance. And then, you know, it doesn't really go well in Baltimore. I think he kind of learns from that, learns how to, you know, continue to hold your head up high when people are kind of starting to doubt your ability. And then he goes to Denver and doesn't have the best time there, gets injured. People start to question whether or not he can still go. Now he gets an opportunity to heal in a system that I think he'll feel relatively comfortable in. It's a team and a franchise, I think, obviously, with his old pal there at general manager. I think it's a good position for him to be in mentally then, to feel a little more comfortable. And also to have someone like Sam Darnold, because not only can Sam Darnold learn from Joe Flacco, but Joe Flacco might be able to bounce some things off of Sam Darnold. I mean, when you have a young guy like that, it could really kind of reinvigorate your older guy. And even though he might not be competing for a starting job, there is still kind of that closeness and that friendship and partnership that builds between a young starter and an older backup that I think he can be ready mentally and physically to step in if he needs to, if Sam Darnold gets injured or if he just has a really bad game, and you can have him step up and you can, you know, have that kind of security blanket of a Super Bowl champion as your backup quarterback. So in case you need to put him in, perfect, he's now in the game. But also just continue to mentor Josh Rosen, continue to mentor Sam Darnold. because New York is not an easy place to play for any sport. And the way that the Jets have not been able to have the same kind of success recently the New York Giants have had. Obviously, it's been a while since they've won a championship, but they've won two championships a lot more recently than the New York Jets have won a championship. So I think there's a lot of pressure on him, and there's a lot of pressure just playing in New York and wanting that city to win championships. And while I don't think Joe Flacco has experienced that kind of pressure, he knows the pressure of a Super Bowl week. He knows the pressure of building to that, having to wait 2 weeks after you win your conference championship game to play in the championship game. So he still understands how to go about handling pressure and how to put himself in good positions. And I think that can only help a young man who, while, yes, people like to jump on him, and even our pal Sean has jumped on him for saying, you know, that he sees ghosts and all that stuff. And, you know, obviously it hasn't been totally smooth sailing for him since he's been in the NFL. But for the most part, I think that he's showing some good signs. He's showing some signs of getting better and becoming more of a leader and being more confident in his on-field play. If you look at just some of the increases that he was able to do from year one to year two, threw for just under 2,900 yards in 2018, threw for just over 3,000 yards in 2019. He threw 17 touchdowns and 15 interceptions in 2018, then threw two more touchdowns the next year and two less interceptions. So again, that looks like that's getting better as well. His completion percentage went from 57% in 18 to 61% in 2019. So he's showing steps of getting better. And you feel like sometimes when you see those kind of minor improvements, is just missing that one kind of last push, that last, you know, shove from behind to really get those motors going and get into that rhythm of being an elite quarterback. And not to say that he will be with Joe Flacco there, but that could be the missing piece, that voice in his ear, that calming veteran championship attitude that helps him get to that next level and helps get the New York Jets back to a possible championship winning position, which they haven't been in quite some time. So I think it's a good thing for the New York Jets. I don't think Joe Flacco will ever really become I don't think he'll become kind of the full-time starter. I don't think that'll really fall into his lap. I think Sam Darnold is there to be the starting guy, and whoever the backup quarterback is, whatever the order of quarterbacks goes from second, third, and fourth string, I think they're going to look at Joe Flacco and hope that he can really instill some more wisdom and some more confidence in Sam Darnold as he continues to get better and better and more used to the NFL lifestyle. I mean, his first two seasons, he's played and started in 13 games. So he has yet to get a full season under his belt. So maybe if he does that with a veteran voice in his ear in an offense that he's getting more comfortable in, then maybe the New York Jets can see a turnaround. And again, in a division that is wide freaking open. We don't know what New England's going to do. We don't know what Miami's going to look like, what Buffalo's going to look like. I mean, there's so many question marks about all four of those teams in the AFC East that this could be, again, that last little push for Darnold and that offense and that team to maybe make a run to the playoffs. But we will see how that goes. And don't forget, speaking of football and speaking of championships, coming up this Monday, you can hear the broadcast of Super Bowl I, the first ever Super Bowl that went down in 1967 at L.A. Coliseum there in Los Angeles, the Green Bay Packers against the Kansas City Chiefs. Back before even the AFL and NFL merger happened in 1970. So you can go and listen to that game right here on ESPN Radio this Monday on Memorial Day starting at 9 a.m. And any football fan out there, I mean, it's amazing what you can find on YouTube nowadays. I've gotten to see some footage from that, but be able to listen to the broadcast of that game and how the Super Bowl era kicked off and how it all started. I would recommend you tune into that if you can. We're going to take a break. When we come back, speaking of the NFL, there is a general manager, another general manager out there, who is not overly concerned about his head coach and quarterback getting along. So we'll talk about that coming up next in the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, as the NFL season continues to creep closer, we have to wait and see what it'll look like as we do get closer to preseason. But with some changes that were made around the NFL this offseason, there is one general manager that is not overly concerned about how his head coach and quarterback will get along. And no surprise, it's Jason Licht of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Of course, the team that brought in Tom Brady this offseason, he is not concerned about having the experience and the veteran quarterback have to kind of bring the young offense along with him and also, test the defense as well. But as I talked just in the last segment about how Joe Flacco can do that for Sam Darnold, Tom Brady can do that for the entire team of Tampa Bay. Because Bruce Arians, as it's been discussed, is well aware of how to handle a veteran quarterback, how to handle an older quarterback, and he was excited and looking forward to the possibility of working with Tom Brady. There was that moment, I think, at the NFL draft when, or not the NFL draft, or was it the draft or the scouting con? I don't think, anyway, there was a moment where he was having an interview, I believe it was the NFL draft, where he said that, if he was asked if you could bring in one quarterback this offseason, who would it be? And he said Tom Brady, and they went out and they ended up getting Tom Brady. And I think Bruce is going to know that he doesn't have to spell it. He doesn't have to hold Brady's hand through all this. He doesn't have to spell everything out letter by letter and make sure they're on the same page. They have enough experience between the two of them in this sport and in the NFL where they'll be able, I think, to jump on the same page rather quickly if they're not already on the same page. And what's great, I think, about that is Tom Brady, while he'll be able to work with what is a very talented Tampa Bay roster in terms of wide receivers and tight ends and weapons that he'll have around him in that passing game, I think he'll also do wonders for the defense as well. A defense that struggled last year at times, that hasn't been the sharpest defense the last few seasons. And I think that when you have to practice against Tom Brady, you're practicing against one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, and that'll make you better just by being on the field and having to think about what he's doing and having to think about how you have to play him. And what's so great is that, if they approach that correctly, then if you feel like you can handle and stop Tom Brady, you can almost, maybe in maybe not a Lamar Jackson or a Patrick Mahomes that can, do donuts and spin around you and go down, touch the goal line, go back and touch the other one, then run in for a touchdown again before you can put a finger on him. But if you can stop Tom Brady, you can most likely stop almost any quarterback in the NFL. So not only does he have the opportunity now to enhance the offensive weapons around him and the offensive talents around him and just pass his knowledge down again. This is a man that has 20 years of experience in the NFL. He's won more championships than any player in NFL history. He's played 9 championship games. So as much as we get annoyed by his success and the success that he and the Patriots had, you can't deny it. And you can't deny that he's going to understand how to succeed in this game and how to succeed at the pro level. So if Bruce Arians can keep a tight enough hold on things, again, when you have the leadership of Brady out there, he's going to make sure the ship is run in a very tight manner as well. So you don't have to be, the kind of whip cracker that maybe you would have to be if you didn't have a veteran type of a voice like a Tom Brady on your team. So I think he doesn't have to necessarily focus all of his energy there. He can look at the team as a whole and be a little more, centered with that team and be able to approach all aspects instead of maybe looking at just his offense or worrying about what his quarterback's going to do or worrying about whether or not the scheme they have is going to help his quarterback not throw a pick six every game. Either way, I think there is a good opportunity for Bruce Arians and Tom Brady to really just kind of to lean on each other in a way that is comfortable for everyone around them. And in an NFC South division this year that looks to be tougher than normal. Obviously, Drew Brees and the Saints. We'll have to see what Matt Rhule and Teddy Bridgewater and Christian McCaffrey can do in Carolina. But Atlanta, possibly making a run down there as well. You just never know what you're going to get from them. But they've shown they have talent and they can compete. We've seen that in the last few years when they made their championship run. But it's an NFC South division that's going to be a little more challenging than it has in the past. So if you have those comforting voices of a Bruce Arians and a Tom Brady kind of both talking to players on offense and defense, I think defensive players can get just as much out of Tom Brady as an offensive player could at this point in his career. I think anyone could really pick his brain and make themselves smarter in the game of football. So if Bruce Arians just kind of takes that, not lackadaisical approach, not trying to say that at all, but if he takes maybe a little more of an easy approach to it and focuses more on the surrounding players, maybe the offensive line and just players that are around Tom Brady instead of Brady himself, then that Bucs team could see an incredible improvement on both sides of the ball and become competitive in a division that I think we are still kind of leaning towards the Saints being in control. But you never know what can happen, especially in the world of the NFL, especially on Sundays. And who knows what's going to happen when Tom Brady and Drew Brees step on the same field for the first time in a Tampa Bay Buccaneers and New Orleans Saints uniform. Obviously, they've played against each other before, but not as division rivals. So that'll be interesting to see. I wouldn't be worried either if I was the general manager of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Why would you be? Your head coach got the guy he wanted, and now he can help build that team on both sides of the ball with one of the center. Now, I think that would make any head coach and GM feel pretty comfortable going into the season. But Brady also in the news for some other reasons. Of course, with Michael Jordan having his Last Dance documentary all about the 97-98 Bulls, you would imagine that Tom Brady's documentary would be right around the corner as well, right? But it is true. Tom Brady is getting a documentary series made about him. It'll be about his 9 Super Bowl appearances, so just his road to his 6 wins and his 3 defeats and how all those different seasons shaped him and what he learned. All pretty much just the story of his championship seasons, or at least his Super Bowl seasons when they would get to the last game. And I can't lie, I'm a little intrigued just because I'm a sports fan. And you don't typically hear a lot from Tom Brady. So if you can just get into the mind of, it was the same thing as watching Michael Jordan. I personally have never been able to have a conversation with him. So I don't know his thought process, what was going through his head different times, and getting to see that documentary, getting to see that kind of inside look. It is interesting. And I was never a Chicago Bulls fan. I'm not a Bulls fan today, but just as a sports fan, and knowing how important MJ was to the world of basketball, it was incredible to get to see that kind of vulnerability from him and understand more of where he was coming from. And if that's the kind of thing we have to look forward to for this Brady documentary, I'm kind of looking forward to it. I'm not going to enjoy watching him win again and again and hear him talk about all that, but I am kind of interested to know if anything was going on in the background. How much they were distracted by some of those news headlines and stuff that came out, before the playoffs or during the playoffs. Just those hurdles that seem to always pop up in front of New England. It might be interesting to kind of see some backstories behind all that and see maybe more of where it came from. So, I kind of rolled my eyes when I first saw the news that he was getting a docuseries. But then, I started thinking about it a little bit more, and it could be extremely interesting if it is, in depth, and we really get to hear. Obviously, his production company is one of the production companies on the project. So I imagine that he felt pretty comfortable during all this. So hopefully that transitions over into the actual film itself, and we get that same kind of vulnerability, that same kind of look into his mindset and his decision making that we did with Michael Jordan in The Last Dance. I think that's what helped make that so unique and so intriguing. And whether you like Brady or not, you can't argue with the success he's had. And to hear from him and hear about that success would be fairly interesting, in my opinion. But we'll see how that goes. That's supposed to come out next year. 2021 is the schedule for the documentary series titled The Man in the Arena, Tom Brady. Interesting. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have some combat lined up for this weekend. So we'll talk about that and rank some of their past events, talking about All Elite Wrestling. That's coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, if there's any wrestling fans out there, All Elite Wrestling's Double or Nothing for 2020 is happening this Saturday. Tomorrow night it is going down. They'll do it without fans at Daly's Place, which is an arena right across, literally, you know, across a hallway, a wide hallway from the Jacksonville Jaguars football stadium, since the owner of the Jaguars is also one of the owners of AEW. But nonetheless, it should be a fun event, shaping up to be a really fun card. AEW has put on 6 official pay-per-view events under All Elite Wrestling's promotion title since their start. So I thought, in honor of their Double or Nothing show coming back around, we would talk again. I'd give you my ranking for the first 6 AEW pay-per-views. Because, of course, they did All In. They did that pay-per-view, but that wasn't necessarily an AEW pay-per-view. That's what kind of was the big opening, you know, shot fired from them in what would later become AEW. So, back again with it, though, and back again with Double or Nothing. So, let's take a look at the way I'm ranking the first 6 AEW pay-per-views, starting with number 6, and that is Fight for the Fallen, an event that happened last July. And it was an event in, good-hearted, with all of the proceeds being donated to the Jacksonville Victim Assistance Advisory Council. So that was some a good feeling around the event there. And the event was pretty fun as well. Some fun matches. Adam Page and Kip Sabian put on a pretty entertaining affair. The Lucha Brothers taking on SoCal and Censored was entertaining. Then, of course, the Kenny Omega and Seema going at it in a singles match was very entertaining to watch. And then, of course, the Young Bucks and Cody and Dustin Rhodes ending the match was quite the scene as well. Bit of an awkward ending, though. I think it was Nick Jackson was trying to make a speech. And then, of course, they were doing a whole bunch of this donation ceremony where they came out with a big check. They were going to hand it over, and that kind of interrupted what he was saying. So it was kind of an awkward transition. He made a joke kind of being, you know, short on time, but it was kind of an awkward ending to the pay-per-view that was really kind. It kind of felt like, I don't want to say publicity stunt. They were using it to kind of show some good nature and making this donation. So that, to have that at the end and kind of rushed into it just kind of made the pay-per-view feel a little awkward at the end. But nonetheless, I thought it was still a good show. Coming in at number 5 is Fyter Fest, which went down June of last year in Daytona Beach, and probably one of the more low-key events, probably the most low-key event that they put on, but nonetheless, still a good, entertaining affair. You had Adam Page defeating Jimmy Havoc and Jungle Boy and MJF in a 4-way match that was very entertaining. Cody and Darby Allin fighting to that time limit draw, which was a bit of a surprise, but I thought it was a very nice touch. And then, of course, having the Elite taking on the Lucha Brothers again in a 6-man tag team match that just went all over the place. And then, of course, Moxley and Joey Janela putting on that non-sanctioned match where you had the broom wrapped in. You had I think thumbtacks were introduced as well at some point. So an interesting match there. Not a lot of star power in that main event, but nonetheless, it was still entertaining, and so was the card. But that is coming in at number 5. At number 4, I have AEW Revolution, which was a pay-per-view event done earlier this year in February at the in Chicago, Illinois, and mostly it's because they really start to feel established now. And seeing that pay-per-view earlier on this year, you had the World Tag Team Championship match, the Women's Championship match on it, having the AEW World Championship main event, it felt so much more cemented while watching that show earlier than having Jon Moxley defeat Chris Jericho at the end of the show. That was awesome. You had a feeling that Jon Moxley's title reign was coming, so to see him and Jericho mixing it up again, was pretty entertaining. So I had that coming in at 4. At number 3, it's AEW Full Gear, which happened at the end of last year in November of 2019. I thought this one just had a lot of interesting and captivating matches from start to end. I mean, starting off with Santana and Ortiz against the Young Bucks in a tag team match was really fun to watch. Adam Page and Pac put on an incredibly fun match. Shawn Spears and Joey Janela had a lot of fun. At least it was fun to watch them in that match. You had Chris Jericho and Cody, of course, with the whole storyline around MJF going on through that match and MJF throwing in the towel for Cody Rhodes. Then, of course, Moxley and Omega in an unsanctioned lights-out match to wrap up the night. Was an attention grabber all the way throughout the over 35-minute match that they put on. So just a really fun show there, a show that kind of I think had us all feeling like AEW was really starting to lock in, understand their product, and how to put on their wrestling shows, and it's been awesome ever since. Then coming in at number two is the original Double or Nothing that happened last year in Las Vegas, Nevada. Of course, it was the big kickoff to AEW. You had all these different tag team matches, and you had a Fatal 4-Way Women's match that was really fun to watch. Cody taking on Dustin Rhodes in one of the most unforgettable wrestling matches of last year. And then, of course, you have Chris Jericho and Kenny Omega battling it out, and that was Jon Moxley's big introduction to everybody in AEW. So just an unbelievable show, an unbelievable crowd, and the kickoff to really the AEW that we have now. But coming in at number one, the best pay-per-view I think they've done so far is AEW All Out. That happened, not All In, All Out, which happened August of last year there in Illinois. And just an unbelievable card for that event, an unbelievable, just unbelievable wrestling. I mean, SoCal Uncensored and Jurassic Express in a six-man tag team match was really fun to start it off. Pac and again, Kenny Omega in a singles match was really fun to enjoy. Cody and Shawn Spears was enjoyable. Then you had Chris Jericho and Adam Page for the inaugural AEW World Championship, and you just can't, you know, play that down as to how important that was, which is why, with that being the main event and Jericho being the first champion they had, that is why that stays at number one. But that's how I feel about the opening or the first six pay-per-views that AEW has put on. I am looking forward to their event this weekend, Double or Nothing, back again. So looking forward to that and what the card might be and how the matches might play out. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. But when we come back, we'll talk quickly about some boxing news as well and a possible return or two there. Coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, as we wrap up this first hour here on the Spencer Wilson Show, today, Friday, May 22nd, interesting news out of boxing is Mike Tyson on a comeback trail. Mike Tyson released a video on Instagram. I think it was only about 9 or 10 seconds worth, but of him just popping off the gloves, still showing some incredible speed, still showing some insane power, which, of course, the video got about 9.5 million views on Instagram, and people started to freak out thinking that Mike Tyson is making his way back to the boxing world. And then we also had news that Evander Holyfield also coming back out of retirement for a charity event. I don't know if that's related to Mike Tyson or not, but that was also reported out of the world of boxing this week. And it's a cool thought, I think, to see. I mean, to think about possibly seeing a Mike Tyson or Evander Holyfield back in the ring is intriguing to some level. It's also a little scary at some level. Not scary because, I mean, I'm not going to ever doubt Mike Tyson that he couldn't knock somebody out. But I don't want to see guys that are in their 50s and getting older get back into a ring and possibly take a beating. Because it just, as soon as he gets punched around a little bit, if this were to happen, I'm not saying obviously he's coming back, but if this were to happen for either men, they get punched around a little bit, and you start to see him kind of wobble and lean and struggle with being in the fight, it quickly goes from cool nostalgia to depressing and scary. And we really just don't want that for any professionals in the combat world, whether it's boxing, MMA, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, whatever it might be. We don't ever want to see somebody fall into that. So hopefully it's just a cool workout video and he's just trying to showing off. He still has some power. And hopefully, you know, we don't have to see Tyson and Holyfield go at it, you know, at the age they are. But I guess we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But that was some interesting news coming out of the world of boxing there. I mean, Tyson has been offered $20 million already for bare knuckle fighting, but I wouldn't advise him to do that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back at the top of the hour with the second hour. Peace for now.